everybody cries. Everybody lives and everybody dies. Everybody eats and everybody loves. Everybody knows what everybody does. Everybody's going through the changes. Every complication. What you say with gesture and expression. In my imagination. Every mobile phone, in every restaurant, everyone we know, and everything you want. Everybody wonders what you're gonna do. Everything is closer, everything is true. Everybody's starting everything again. Everybody's outside now, they're coming in. Everybody's going through the garbage, looking for inspiration. Some will find it staring at the ceiling of the subway station. Everyone you love.
I love that album so much. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the roundtable for this Friday edition, the edition we didn't know if it was going to happen. And because you are the most wonderful listeners in all of radio, it has happened and we are here. For those of you who missed it, we had a fun drive while you were away. I don't know how you missed it, but it was an amazing fun drive. It was really incredible. And we started on Monday. And we ended yesterday, 3 days and a morning, and raised $1.25 million in that time, plus the lockbox that you've been a part of that we had segments for at 9:30, from 9 to 9:30 and from 11:30 to 12. Man, did you all come out. And the love, the support, the kind things that you said, the need that you have for this radio station, the beautiful wishes and beautiful words and beautiful expressions is something that will keep us on cloud nine for a really, really long time. We were all talking yesterday after the fun drive, and we, as a group, said that for those of us, especially for those of us who have been through a bunch of these, was the most amazing and meaningful drive I think any of us have ever been a part of. It was simply gorgeous. And everybody here, the staff, the crew, everybody worked so damn hard. It was everybody did their part. We had a great time. It was almost like going on a retreat. It was a bonding experience. Like, we just had so much fun with each other doing it. And I'll be honest with you. I mean, making money helps. Like, it would have sucked if we had done all that and we didn't make money. But we made money on top of it, and that was really great. Folks like Teresa and Jim and so many others who came in and helped us, and all of our volunteers, all of the people who donated meals, all of the people who called in or went to their device. I hope you know how much it means to us. I still find it hard not to get like emotional talking about it, because it was such a beautiful, beautiful drive. And the other thing that I'll say, and this is more, I wouldn't say crass, but it's more, you couldn't turn that thing off. Like, if you wanted to stop, and the money just kept coming in. Like, if you wanted to slow it down, the old days, like, you could slow a fun drive down. Like, you would just talk about something else. And the only reason that you would do that is so you could get more volunteers in, or you could wait for another premium to get ready or something like that. There was no stopping this thing at all. It was a runaway freight train. And that was a really wonderful feeling. And it didn't matter, because everybody was ready for it. And I've said this a million times to anyone who's asked. We have the best listening audience in the entire world. We have incredible leadership. We have incredible, incredible staff, management, and just from the pitchers to the volunteers, it was just remarkable and beautiful, and something that we will not soon forget. So thank you from the bottom of our hearts. We always said that we think we're all on the same page, that the one thing we wanted to do was get back to regular programming. And we did it in just 3 days, 3.5 days, and we got back to regular programming. And here we are. So I won't take much longer in thanking you, because I want to get back to regular programming. We'll go to 11 o'clock today. We have a lot to discuss. Mike Spain, first thing Mike said when he came in is like, you know, a lot of news happens just over 3.5 days. A lot of things go on that you didn't get to talk about. And that's absolutely true. So we're going to try to catch up. We have got a lot to talk about. Also, I will, I'll say this at the risk. I will say that this group was fairly curated today. I love all of our panelists. Our panelists are wonderful, wonderful people. But the four people in this room mean so much to me, and are so helpful all the time in putting this show on and putting the show together. And I really all wanted them here today so that they could be with us as we start up again and do what we do. And so it's an absolute delight to have these four individuals here on the panel today, because I just they're dear friends, and I think the world of them, and I'm so happy that they're here to join us in this, because so many people who phoned in told us how much they loved individual panelists and panelists and the panel at large, and are so appreciative of the work and what they bring to it. So thanks to all of you. We love you. This is probably where I should tell you we'll be back in 4 months to ask you for money again. But thank you again for being with us. It really means the world to us. And in a time, and I think I was talking to my wife about this last night, it was like, in a time where it's really hard to find something that makes you like truly happy, this was something that made me truly, truly happy and gave me hope that this many people came out. Was it 7,000? I think the number was 7,000.
7,000 well people. Over six, yeah.
And that's not the number of donations. That's the number of individual people. So, because a lot of people gave like eight times, you know.
Right.
But it was, that was 7,000 people. And it's just
a lot of new members too, right?
So many new members, so many new sustainers. And kudos to the crew and the staff to really to shepherd that effort and to make it happen. So, again, thank you very, very much.
I'd also like to add that I found it astounding. I mean, it was so like community building and community affirming, but also not only did you all support this station, but you supported such important causes. I think building in the support for the groups like the Unity House and the food pantries and the
Trinity Alliance
and the environmental issues, all of whom are under strain because of, you know, not only is the station under strain, but just really kudos to the station for doing that innovative. I don't know if anyone else does that. I'm not saying they don't. I'd never seen that before. But think about tremendous help for this station, but tremendous help for all of those other causes, and to remind people that it was just really so uplifting all around, and people were eager. I mean, I took one call where the person said, well, I want to make sure I can give to the food pantries, even though they haven't said it yet. Can I do that? You know?
Yes.
You know what I mean? And
yeah.
So really wanting to, what an amazing community that wants to not only support the radio, but these other causes. And the fact that the station enables that, just so affirming.
We had a toast amongst the staff yesterday afternoon. And our CEO, Sarah Gilbert, who is brilliant and is just so really has I mean, she came into this job when, like, hi, welcome to WAMC. Oh, by the way, we're taking all your funding away. This is what, you know.
And you have to make it up.
Right. You know, and she walked into this and has just been remarkable. And but one of the things she said yesterday during the toast was, if you ever had, she was saying this to the staff, if you ever had any doubt of what this radio station means to this community, and if you ever had any doubt of what this radio station means to individuals and to listeners, you certainly found out over the last 3.5 days. And that is so, so true. Again, we thank you very, very much. The voice you just heard was that of Teresa Bourgeois, public policy and communications expert and and frequent volunteer. And we thank you very much for that. Very, very nice.
I like to hear, listen to folks and hear from them. So it was a privilege to do it, really. It was just so affirming. It was really, really, in these times, so uplifting. So thank you all. You're awesome.
We welcome Judy Patrick to the show. Judy has been vacationing, and we are thrilled that she is back. She is safe. She is sound. She is probably still basking in the glory of her vacation, but probably also a little happy to be back.
It's true. I'm very glad to be here. I'm very fortunate to be able to travel. It's a good perspective for people to have. I understand not everybody can, but it's nice to hear people in other countries react to what's happening in the U.S. And it's, you know what? It's not always all about the U.S.
Yeah, I know. It's not about us. It's not about us. Well, we have to change that, don't we? Where'd you go?
I went to an island off the coast of Italy called Sardinia. Great place. Went to France for quite a bit of time, and then to Prague, where I stumbled upon a anti-fascist rally at the tail end of it, where a young man wanted to come up and talk to me about the New York City mayoral race and Mandami, really into it. I was like, well, you know this? And yeah, he did know it.
Well, that sounds like a vacation.
Yeah.
That's great. Very nice. Well, I love the pictures that you sent. I love
the dip.
The dip, you and Steve, and very, very nice. And what, 3 different places?
We did, yes.
Yeah, very, very nice. Mike Spain is here, former Times Union Associate Editor. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. Very happy to be here. And I'll add my congratulations to you all. It was phenomenal.
Thank you very, very much. Appreciated. Mark Whitman has been Mark was gone for a few weeks. We're glad to have Mark back. Thrilled to have him in this room today. And investment banker on Wall Street and our a deep thinker on these issues. And we're thrilled to have him with us this morning. Good morning, Mark. How are you?
I'm good, Joe. Congratulations to everyone. It certainly is a testament to this station's mission. And as you say, the listeners and all who toil here, including leadership, to support that mission. It's great to be here on a bonus day.
Yeah, that's right. It's a bonus show. It's like they have those lost episodes of the Honeymooners. Like this is what it was sort of like, oh, we didn't expect them to have one today. Yeah, right, exactly. I didn't mention, I cut myself off, but the music coming in was David Byrne's new album, Who Is This Guy? David Byrne performed at Proctor's a couple of weeks ago, about 3 weeks ago. One of the best concerts I've ever seen in my life. I think I may have mentioned that on the air. But the new album is just stunning. It's just great. And we'll be playing portions of that in celebration of our fun drive victory throughout the morning this morning. All right, let's get going. And so now, while we have pumped you up and told you about all of the wonderful things that are going on, we'll go to the news of the day, and we'll take care of that. Burst that bubble as quickly as we blew it up. Here we go. Letitia James was indicted yesterday. We expected this. I think we expected this, even though after the Comey indictment, the president was insistent that he had no list. He had no list of people that he was gunning for. He was not looking out. They were simply random investigations, and there was no hit list, as it were. And then he said, Letitia James will be next. And guess what? She was next. She became the second Trump foe charged in a case that career prosecutors had turned down. The Justice Department obtained the indictment against Letitia James Thursday, accusing her of committing mortgage fraud when she purchased a property in Virginia. The indictment on one count of bank fraud and one of making a false statement makes James the second of President Trump's political foes to be charged in the Eastern District of Virginia since Trump pushed out the top prosecutor there and appointed a close ally, Lindsey Halligan, to replace him. Halligan, who had no previous experience as a prosecutor, obtained an indictment 2 weeks ago against former FBI Director James Comey on charges of making a false statement to Congress. He has pleaded not guilty. Halligan presented the case against James to a grand jury in Alexandria. It is unusual for a politically appointed top U.S. attorney to present a case herself, suggesting that the office struggled to find a career attorney that was willing to take on that particular assignment. Let's begin with Judy Patrick.
So it's not uncommon. Well, it's not uncommon for grand juries to indict once a prosecutor comes before and presents information. But it's possible for a grand jury to present a no bill, which is we're not going to indict. And that didn't happen in this case. It's very clear that President Trump had James Comey, Letitia James, and Adam Schiff. That's the money on the next one. Whether that will come in a week or so is probably the only thing to bet on. Because he said so in a tweet that the Wall Street Journal is reporting that he mistakenly put out as a Truth Social post. He meant to do this as a separate message. That's going to be really come into play as all of these people, all three of these people, make their case for this to be dismissed as, you know, just a wrongful prosecution. That I guess we're getting used to the fact that the President of the United States is controlling the Department of Justice. Now, if Letitia James committed bank fraud, let's go forward with it. Let's see what the information is. I think today's story will probably be a call from Republicans in New York State to have her step aside while this case is going forward. We'll see what happens with that. I'm sure she won't. Bottom line here is all the other people who dare to speak up, who dare to challenge the president. I mean, the climate of fear is real in this country at this point.
Absolutely. Mike.
Yeah, I think your last point there is really the big picture here. For everybody that he attacks publicly and is able to achieve an indictment against and publicly attacking them, President Trump has silenced many, 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 many others who were just going to duck their heads and say, you know, I'm going to lay low. I'm not going to stick my neck out right now. Let's see how this plays out. And the chilling effect of that is really stunning. Media companies have gotten down on their knee and made settlements with him. You know, those are famous, what CBS did about the editing of an interview that was on 60 Minutes of Kamala Harris, or ABC bended its knee when they reached a settlement because George Stephanopoulos made a remark that Trump was convicted of rape when he was convicted of civil sexual assault in a civil trial. And, they could fight these, and there's precedent for winning those cases, but they bend their knee on it. And that's the same with legislators, even some Democrats, Democratic governors are being silent as Trump rallies the National Guard to go into Democratic-run cities. So what the lesson of Letitia James and James Comey and now Fannie Willis of Georgia is also on the short list, another black woman, by the way. You know, he seems to have a thing about going after and criticizing black women. And then Adam Schiff, the sitting senator from California. You know, these are just used by Trump to make a message to others. You go against me and you're going to get it.
Mark Whitman.
The Financial Times had a headline which I thought said it all, or at least caught the headline, which was New York Attorney General Letitia James indicted after pressure from Trump. Bank fraud is real. Trump case, when he was found guilty of it in New York State, a lot of his apologists tried to wish away the fact that it is a real crime. And it's a real crime because the United States government and therefore the taxpayers stand behind banks when things go bad. Just look at the mortgage crisis. She may have committed a crime here, but it's more like a foot fault, frankly, than something really serious. And even the quantity that's been alleged, it was allegedly a $105,000 mortgage. And the indictment says that it was she got $19,000 in gains by calling it a secondary property for her as opposed to a rental property. I guarantee you that there's no real finance that gets a benefit of $19,000 on a $105,000 mortgage. That's obviously a trumped up calculation, frankly. The one thing other panelists have talked about a lot of why we don't like this. The one thing I think we really need to think hard about in this country, Democrats and Republicans alike, is what Trump is doing is placing this is upping the ante on losing elections by an immeasurable quantum. It used to be the case you lost an election if you were a supporter of the current administration. You went to a think tank or a university and you got a pretty nice gig. You waited till, if you weren't too old, the next time your side got to go at it, you could go back into power. Now the consequences of losing an election are potentially being hauled before a court for cases of wrongs that are rarely ever prosecuted, Miss mortgage fraud and then quantum of it being one. And I really do worry about what that does in terms of the pressure not to lose elections, which we already saw the Republicans took extraordinarily seriously two elections ago. And I don't think enough focus has been placed on that. We got to figure out a way in this country to do politics differently. I don't believe in the both sides-ism argument of the lawfare, but I do believe both sides have to get involved in straightening this out.
Teresa.
You know, I think, again, shocking but not surprising and way outside the norms of our democracy and of our systems. And according to, you know, I'm not a lawyer, according to legal experts and, you know, based on what the DOJ staff and others have said, who've tracked this case in Comey's, it's a weak case. We'll see, you know, the system, let the system work itself out. He's likely to lose in court, people say, but he's already, sadly, I think he's already gotten some wins out of this. You know, he wanted to embarrass her, you know, taint her and Comey, and he succeeded in doing that. Also, you know, it's the classic move that he has about distraction. You know, this distracts from all the time people are talking about this and news folks have been on this and Comey intently. They're not talking about the skyrocketing rise in healthcare premiums or, you know, not focusing on the defense bill that went through the Senate last night that included all the Republicans supporting a vote to use federal dollars, over $1 billion in federal money, to restore a plane that'll become Trump's private plane after he you know, leaves office, about the Trump-induced crisis in family farming. You know, it draws attention off away from all of those things. But I think the other problem is that these kind of politically motivated revenge actions and cases also shift attention within the DOJ away from other things. It will never know the cost. I mean, that has such a high cost. And we'll never know exactly. But all the time that the DOJ staff are spending on things like this, his, you know, pet peeves or his, you know, perceived enemies, they're not spending on other investigations. And I think that has a pretty high price tag. It has a high price tag for the people who've left the DOJ or have been driven out of the department in tremendous amounts of technical expertise among prosecutors because they wouldn't handle cases like this or they didn't want to deal with them. And I also think about the fact that with a case like this where these folks have been improperly charged because of who they are, because of the high focus on the topic, it gets a lot of light. It gets a lot of attention. They both have high-powered lawyers, you know, who will clear them. But think about all the people around the country right now who have been, shall we say, questionably charged by the government because of the way that Trump and his folks are acting, all the people who are about to be deported. And a light is not shown on those individual cases. they don't have the kind of representation. And you know, I've heard a couple of other people talk about this, but I think we really have to worry about not just this improper use of our judicial system or our immigration system, but all the other people out around the country who, whether because they protested something that the Trump administration didn't like, or they're part of, they're swept up citizens or not in this deportation campaign, who don't have the light shown on them and who don't have a legal representation. I think across the board, this raises a lot of serious questions about our norms that are being broken.
We'll pause there. We'll take a break. And when we come back, we'll go to a few listener letters and then move on to other topics. We have a lot to get to this morning. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We will return right after this short break.
My apartment is my friend. The days of laughter and joy. When
you have witnessed my confusion. Yes, indeed you have. That is David Byrne, the new album, Who is the Sky? And we are back on the roundtable panel this morning talking about Letitia James at the moment and the indictment that was announced yesterday. So we have letters on this. Let's go to them, and then we'll move on to other subjects. Dan says, we should be congratulating the New York Attorney General on this indictment. I hear it's a springboard to the highest office in the land.
Good for Dan.
Sad and funny and sad.
Russ says, if the story were to be accurately reported, President launches baseless revenge prosecutions against enemies, the regime would begin to fall. But the media keeps emphasizing the horse race angle, likelihood that the prosecution will succeed. This is all self-censorship. How would the journalists on this panel like to respond to that?
It seemed like it was pretty objective reporting to me. I agree, you can't sugarcoat this, or you have to call it for what it is, but I think that's for the opinion journalist to write about. I think if you're reporting an indictment's an indictment. I think the idea that they are clearly calling out the fact that Trump ordered this, essentially, I think that's high up in the story, and I think that's where it should be.
Mike?
Agreed. It is an unusual situation. It's not a typical investigation launched from within by investigators. It was ordered by the White House. That's very clear. Trump has made it very clear. And that is a part of the news story, I think, objectively speaking. I think that's an important fact.
Anyone else want in on that?
Well, I mean, I'm interested in what Mark said fascinated me about that it's not really $19,000. It's more like $1,000. And I didn't see that. Was that covered somewhere? I didn't see that. But I think that's a... You know, it's that kind of detail that I think is important. I don't know. I thought it got overplayed. It's all about the politics of it.
Well, it's about the politics of it, of course, yes. But also, I mean, I think that the key, to me, the objective part that I've seen in every single solitary story, as well as in addition to the one that I read this morning to you all, was that everyone says... that this went through, despite the fact that they couldn't find anybody else to lead the case. This has been around for a while. They've tried, and nobody said, "Well, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to put my reputation on the line. I'm not going to do it." And finally, they found someone who would. So that's certainly
I'd like to add, too, it's an important part of the story, and it's been in the stories that I've read that Letitia James, when she ran in 2018 for Attorney General of New York, promised that she would look and go after and investigate and prosecute, if warranted, Donald Trump for his own allegations that he was playing fancy with his mortgage applications and his loan applications, et cetera. And she took him to court, and he was convicted. And his corporation was convicted of playing with numbers in a major, major, major way. And, you know, that it looks like she had an axe to grind with him, but she was also the attorney general going after a major figure in a major banking situation. So, I mean, but it's regardless of whether this the allegation is true, and it seems to be very, very, very minor, and there's a lot of arguments to be made that it was simply a minor overlooking of a box or something like that. I mean, however it plays out, it's clear that it's political vindictiveness and vindictive prosecution.
But don't you think, Mike, that, you know, that example gets brought up all the time, and I think it's important to bring it up about her saying in the campaign, but didn't she say that in response to what came out publicly? I mean, it was already publicly known about his actions.
You're right. Those were revealed, and she said, I'll go after that. She was clear about it, but
right,
in fairness, she did run for office promising to prosecute Donald Trump. That doesn't change it. If he was,
but because there were all of these issues out there of things that he and his company had done.
Right.
It's
she
not
didn't
that,
just go in there and dig this out of nowhere.
Right.
And,
it's not that I don't like the guy, so I'm going to find something on him. It's that all of these questions had been raised
publicly
about his dealings and his questionable dealings. And she said, I'm going to go after these questionable dealings.
Oh, Teresa, I very much respect you, but I think you're rounding the edges in Letitia James's favor. By the way, what she may or may not have done doesn't excuse what the Justice Department is trying to do to her. Okay,
exactly.
So let's state that as a precursor. But Letitia James effectively said to the populace of New York State, I want to be your attorney general. We all hate Trump. I'm going to look everywhere I can to hold him to account. She used it literally as a campaign
slogan.
Because
there was public information out there about the range of things he had done.
Well, to the because there are lots of becauses in the following sense. There certainly he had been held, he and his father jointly and his family had been held responsible for illegal conduct in New York State prior. So there was that. But that wasn't the only factor. People hated Donald Trump politically. And she was capitalizing on that as a politician running for a law enforcement job. I said it then. I'll say it again now. It was inappropriate when she did it. It's still inappropriate that she had done it. But it does not excuse what the Trump administration is trying to do. And that's back to my original point. We cannot in this country make losing elections so costly for either side, or we're going to make 2000 look like a cakewalk if we don't figure out a way to stop this collectively.
The other thing that I struggle with, and also now I'm belaboring this topic, but when people are described as his enemies and, you know, just how to anybody who doesn't agree with, you know, that he's going after his enemies or political enemies as opposed to, I don't know. I just think that to describing everybody as his, was she doing this? Did she do her job because she was an enemy of his? I don't know. I think that's a problem.
Teresa, I actually think that's you hit upon something, and I haven't totally formed
my
views around this. But again, sort of we all got to call this differently. I saw a poster today when I picked up donuts for one of those faux joint ice posters, right? Do you have an inferiority complex? Is a particular part of your body small? Did you not do well in school? Are you so ugly you have to hide your face? You know, joint ice, right? Now, you know, if we wind back the clock to when we were defending...
There's nothing funny about it except everything.
Go ahead. Well, look, I always tell...
And you get $50,000 bonus
right. For those who know my son, I won't mention his name, but we always have these conversations. There are things you can laugh about. I say there are conversations you can have and laugh about around this dinner table that I don't want you to have when you leave this dinner table until you really know people intimately. Because you and I may laugh at that in one level. But you know what I hate about that? I hate those people are duly authorized law enforcement. They may be doing something that I find detestable, okay? I may want to protest. I may want to sit there with a fishing rod and hold a donut in front of them, right? Ice fishing is what they call that, apparently. But when you start to actually do things like encumber them physically when they're trying to do their job that they're legally allowed to do, you've crossed a line. And Teresa, you point up something very interesting, is when do those who were part of the legal system that tried to hold Trump and others to account for allegedly and in some cases proven illegal acts, when do they become not just law enforcement but political enemies?
They're labeled as enemies.
I get it. That's wrong. It's wrong. Look, it's one thing for, say, you know, Chris Rock to make the ICE joke. It's another thing to make it in more sort of politically disciplined discussion circles. And so I think this whole country, we've all lost our bearings. I mean, the gauges on our dashboard are all wrong. And if you, on both sides, you got to look at that and take a really deep breath, because we're not going to like the consequences of what we're doing here.
Well, I like, a friend of mine last night sent me some video from Portland, Oregon, where out in front of the ICE detention center where there were people being brought, there were five or six people. They're dressed up in these massive blow-up costumes of bears and old dinosaurs and stuff, and they're playing music and they're dancing around. And that it's, you know, war-torn Portland. But it's a way of making the point, but in a way that is peaceful. And so, you know, anyway, and I think that's what needs to be figured out, how to make the point, be a presence, but do it in a way that's peaceful and not putting both sides at risk.
One of the local TV stations out in Portland has a live cam, or a live camera focused on the front of the ICE building all the time, so anybody can go and see, check out what's happening out front there. So it's pretty cool. It's pretty good use of a local news network and what they do. You know, bolster Mark's argument about the retribution or the reactive retribution. I heard Democrats yesterday saying, just wait, all these people in the Department of Justice who are facilitating this, we're going to be in power in a couple of years, and you know what goes around, you know, comes around. So I've heard this already.
But this is just not the norms.
We are going to change the subject for no other reason, because we have a lot of other things to talk about.
Thank you.
We welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. 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 So let's see. The next item up for discussion here is the bring it up. I want to talk about the shutdown and the standoff. This obviously is an issue that is been going on well before we went on our 3-day hiatus, four morning hiatus, and here we are still talking about this as the shutdown continues. Did it affect you at all while you were traveling?
Oh, I had to wait longer in line to get back in the country, but I eventually got back in.
Good.
I was worried because I made some, you know, incendiary tweets when I was abroad, so I was tried to, you know, temper my opinions.
Great. Democratic alarm over an unbound Trump fuels shutdown standoff. The threat of rising Obamacare premiums has been Democrats' main focus in the public debate, but the president's defiance of laws, norms, and congressional constraints has helped hold them together in opposition. Democrats in Congress have been relentless about casting the government shutdown clash as a fight over helping Americans pay for health insurance. But there is another far deeper issue driving the impasse: their outrage about what is happening across the country under a president they regard as lawless and unchecked. Mark Whitman.
So, Joe, I haven't been on talking about this topic. So let me just say, I remember the old Chuck Schumer who didn't want to hand this cudgel to Trump.
In March, right?
Yeah. I was with him then. I am not with the Democrats now. And let me list. I understand that. I think the article made a good point, which is that people are just so upset. It's like, let's just throw sand in the works with respect to the Republicans and what is seen as their government. But I think we're missing. I think a lot of the analysis misses a few things. We as a country may or may not want to continue to subsidize Obamacare, which has become, because of the way the insurance pools have worked out, not as expected. It's become a lot more expensive than we thought. The measure that's being potentially reversed here was a measure that the Democrats said was temporary to help people pay for Obamacare during the pandemic and to help people who were stretched. We may or may not want as a country to continue to sort of socialize medicine. That's a different discussion. But to me, the real sort of the joke, if you will, was a sad joke that people are missing in this shutdown is Democrats continue to try and increase the size of the of our social state without paying for it. And the Republicans keep trying to pay for ever less or keep trying to basically give people larger tax cuts when the current system can't even afford the bills that that come due now. So both sides are still talking well past one another here. And the fact that the news media hasn't even focused in on what the right question is regarding the shutdown, I just think emphasizes that. The fact that Chuck Schumer now has, out of political expedience, sort of taken the helm on the shutdown, there's an interesting dilemma that he's going to face at the end of this, which I also want to highlight, which is presumably the Republicans will give in and give some measure of continued subsidy on the Obamacare premiums. But Schumer doesn't want it to be so large that the Democrats, still can't use this issue in the midterms to continue to beat the Republicans over the heads. So Schumer knows that at the end of this, everyone on his party is going to have to sort of publicly criticize him for not giving enough. But if he gets everything he wants, he takes away one of the Democrats' more effective political issues. So to me, Joe, the fact that these folks aren't meeting and are talking past each other is just a microcosm of what's wrong and why we're in this difficulty. And I got bad news for everybody. For Halloween, I'm going to dress up as the world financial markets and politicians and taxpayers in this country should be terrified, because if we don't get this stuff right, the world financial markets will make us. And just look at what happened to Greece when they had to swallow a pill of austerity. It's going to be really gruesome when all these bills come due.
Mike?
Yeah, I think it is important to underscore that the Obamacare subsidies that were approved during COVID were not, you know, did have a sunset. But the reality now is that people are going to be really hurt by it. I think that's been documented. People who might have a family income of $64,000 a year, they're going to be doubling what they're paying. And what that means is a lot of people will go without health care. And clearly, there was not a good plan in place to finance this long term and keep it at that level. Why can't there be some reasonable discussion about ways to mitigate the impact and factor that into the way we finance our government? And, you know, you're right. We did hand out, you know, a huge tax break for people in a higher income bracket that don't have to worry about things like health care nearly as much. And it's true that people who are less able to afford health care are going to have to pay more. Why can't that be the discussion? And this is the only cudgel the Democrats have to bring it up. I think it's not unreasonable to bring it up now. It's not a great way to do it. It's the wrong way to do it. But if there's no other way to get it onto the table, it's reasonable right now to bring it to the table. As far as strategy for the midterms, I know that's all in the back of mind, and Schumer is certainly worried about his own seat, let alone winning back the possibility of winning back the Senate. But there could be like some kind of deal brokered, if people were reasonable, extend some funding, maybe back it off gradually while there's a commission set up, a reasonable, true bipartisan effort. I know that sounds pie in the sky, but why can't there even be a discussion about it? And John Thune, the Senate Majority Leader, his whole approach to this is, and the same for Mike Johnson in the House, is just wait out the Democrats and let them stumble and we'll get what we want, and nothing will happen for people who pay health care premiums. And in the end, it's the Republicans basically blowing the bottom out of Obamacare, which is what Trump wanted all along.
We will take a break. When we come back, we'll hear from Judy and Teresa on this subject. We welcome your letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this.
Love is peace. Love is such a tasty treat. But when it's done, love is on, love is clear.
We were just saying, love is such a tasty treat. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable, to our panel discussion, listening to the music of David Byrne. Who is the Sky is the new album. It is out. He's out on the road. And if you get a chance, if it's near you, wherever you may be or traveling to, it is well worth it. It's an amazing, amazing show. Let me see. Oh, I want to make one mention of something, just a plug, if I may. On tomorrow night at the Bardavon in Poughkeepsie, New York, there is going to be the Eleanor Roosevelt Center and PEN America are joining forces to put the cap on Banned Books Week, and they're going to be presenting the Eleanor Roosevelt Banned Book Awards. They have asked me very sweetly and kindly to give the award to Margaret Atwood for her incredible achievement and work. Of course, The Handmaid's Tale is one of the most banned books in the country. I think it was a couple of years ago, it was number one next to 1984, and now I think it's 1984, Handmaid's Tale, and A Clockwork Orange are the three that are the most banned books in the country. Margaret Atwood will be at the event, and I will be interviewing her. I said, oh, it's going to be an interview, and I was chastised lovingly by the Eleanor Roosevelt Center, who said, no, it's going to be a fireside chat. And I said, okay, I will do that. It's a fireside chat.
That's sweet.
Tickets are available still if you want to go. Bardavon.org, Bardavon.org. And we're going to be talking a lot. Amazing authors, amazing work that is being done in the name of free speech. And I don't know if we'll get to it. There's also a great story that came out about a librarian who just received a settlement after being fired for trying to keep books in a library. So we'll talk about that hopefully as well at the end. But we'd love to have you come with us. I think it's going to be a really special, amazing night. And I'm more than a little excited to sit down and talk to Margaret Atwood. So all of that tomorrow night at the Bardavon, bardavon.org. Let us go and continue to discuss the story at hand about the shutdown. Teresa Bourgeois, I want to ask you about the shutdown, what your thoughts are on this. One of the things that you have made very clear, and I think it's interesting, is that so much of this is about healthcare. Also, that this goes hand in hand with the enrollment period for the Affordable Care Act, for the ACA, and which I believe, what, November 1st? And so how all of that kind of merges together and is important to realize.
Right. Well, I, with all due respect, Mark, brilliant, but in this case, I think I fundamentally disagree with what you had said about Schumer and here's why. I think there are a couple of things. I think there is a difference between March and now, and that is because we're up against some very firm deadlines on the Affordable Care Act. I think a lot of focus on discussion about the shutdown has been on the politics of it, who wins and who loses politically. And I think where the focus needs to be is on the impact of the budget cuts on households, on businesses, on communities. And I think it needs to be on what the impact of the Trump administration, congressional Republicans, on their budgetary decisions on everyday lives of working class Americans and others who are living at the margins. And I think that that's what the Democrats are trying to do. And I think the reason they've narrowed in on healthcare is because these subsidies, like the Thune says, oh, we'll get to that. And Johnson, Speaker Johnson says, oh, you know, we'll take that up. That's not an issue for 2 years from now. Well, in fact, it's an issue right now. Right now, people who are get their health care coverage through the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, they are getting notices. And some of them are getting notices saying that their premiums are going to double or triple or more. Many of them will be priced out of the market. They won't be able to afford it. But they have to make, if they want health coverage by January 1st, they can make those decisions starting November 1st, but they have to make them by December 15th, and they have to know what that coverage is going to be. And unless the Congress decides very, very soon, that information won't be available to them. And it will not only if it will directly impact those folks who get their health coverage through Obamacare, but it will indirectly right now affecting all of us, because in anticipation of 20 million people losing their health care, the markets.
Here's some info about dissipation.
Yes. We will not out the panel member whose device decided to talk back to them.
Siri's
his reflexes are great, though.
Yeah, that was good.
Whoever your person is disagrees with me.
Teresa, I want to apologize
for that technique.
I just want to say I feel for you. I had that. I was doing the first and second reading at church when that happened.
Oh, no.
To me.
Oh, my.
So,
all right. They feel
the reading from the Book of Numbers was interrupted briefly by that. Go ahead.
Anyway, I just think that timing is of the essence right now, and I think what the Democrats are trying to do is force the Republicans to the negotiation table, because so far, throughout this whole process, they have refused to negotiate with the Democrats. And, you know, what's astounding is that Trump has had one meeting with the leaders. And now he's, you know, he's not talking to them again. They just are choosing not to negotiate. And I think that's there's a really high price tag for that. And you say, well, these were intended to be temporary. Well, it is true that they set a deadline, but think about what was in the Republicans' bill that they passed, the, you know, big whatever bill that they passed. All of the health care provisions, all of them are temporary.
The big whatever bill.
I'm not going to use their nomenclature. I'm not going to say it.
I can't say it. It's good.
But think about it. Everything, all the tax cuts in there for the wealthiest of Americans, those were permanent. The health care provisions were temporary, all of them temporary. They weren't permanent. They're not permanent. So when it comes time for them to expire, are they going to stop all of that, all those Medicare changes and stuff? They're not, because that's how you do it for spending. Now, so the question is, these issues around health care, skyrocketing premiums, it's going to affect the individuals who don't have coverage, but it's also going to affect the hospitals. It's going to have an impact on them. And those hospitals are often the anchor in communities, the economic anchor in communities. So there's going to be a spillover effect on them. Economic impacts are going to ripple through the system. And Vice President Vance, Speaker Johnson, Thune, they keep saying this can wait, this can wait. It can't wait. They're also lying about the immigrants and those who don't have a legal status in this country, and saying that the Democrats just want to give, I heard it on the radio again yesterday, they want to give $1 trillion to people who are here illegally. That's absolutely not true. Federal law prohibits it. That's not what they're saying. They're conflating a different issue, which is, and this is a Reagan-passed initiative, that there's a federal law that if anybody who goes into an emergency room in critical condition, they need to be cared for. I saw an analysis from the KFF Health News the other day that that's a 0.4%, 0.4% of people, and that they pay more in taxes than it costs to cover that. But it's not just health; these health insurance questions that have been cut and have economic impact. There's energy costs that have been cut. Energy programs, clean energy, and that's causing a spike in our electricity rates. You know, there's cuts in that the president did unilaterally and illegally that he did in law enforcement, across the board in law enforcement, in education. And so what about the crisis in family farms, right? All of these things need to be addressed. They need to be negotiated. And the Republicans aren't doing that, and Democrats are drawing the line, and they say that the Trump administration, this lawlessness and these indiscriminate cuts need to stop. We need to go back to governing the way that we're supposed to.
Judy.
So the spending bill is the leverage the Democrats have to get whatever they want, and at this point they feel that health is an important issue and a winning issue. The polling shows that, you know, American public are blaming both sides equally. I think at a time when trust in government continues to decline, this is the kind of action that will continue to erode the American people's trust in government. They don't. On health, I agree with a lot of what Teresa said, but I think the overarching issue of the overall care, health, cost of health care for all of us. The reason the Affordable Care Act, the premium support was increased was because people weren't going to it because it was so expensive. I mean, the cost of health insurance for businesses is enormous. People, and that continues to go up and up every day. I know a family of four, two adults, two small children. They're paying $2,500 a month for health insurance, and that's a high deductible plan. We need to talk about that as well as making health insurance or health care affordable for everyone. The cost is runaway. Runaway increasing, and we need to address that because it's not sustainable. And at the same time, I hear from doctors that, you know, their Medicare reimbursement rates are on the decline. So and everyone around this table can probably tell us a tale about how long it took for them to get in to see a primary care doctor or a dentist or a specialist. I mean, there are so many things wrong with our health insurance system or our healthcare system at this point that needs a broader discussion as well. I understand what the Democrats are trying to do at this point. They're viewed as a weak party. They're trying to show some strength. You know, kudos for that. Let's see where they get with it. Maybe they will get a modicum of increase in the subsidies for the Affordable Care Act. But the bottom line is next year, we're all going to be paying a lot more for healthcare than we really should.
But don't you think it's more than just trying to show strength? It's trying to preserve some of the health insurance infrastructure. And I mean, it constantly needs to be improved. But I think the Republicans, they tried up or down votes to end Obamacare, and they couldn't get the votes within their own caucus to do that, right? So what they did in this last bill is try to dismantle it in a backdoor way. And if these cuts continue, that's exactly what they're going to do. And then what is the cost to our economic system of that, as opposed to coming to the table, negotiating, and work together to try to improve the system? But when you go back to more than 20 million people, more people uninsured, that's going to increase medical bankruptcies. I mean, the economic ripples of that.
I kind of agree with Mark.
Our problem.
I think for the Democrats, they may be hoping that they don't get everything that they want because at the end of the day, it's all about power. And
but
to reclaim
what?
Power, they want to win next year, and they want to take back the House. And they're more likely to take back the House if this stays in place.
I don't see any evidence that they are hoping that this doesn't work. I mean, they have just this alone has started to get people people are getting notices now.
Mm-hmm.
They're a family.
I'm getting
notices. A family of four. Their
insurance
was $8,000 a year, and now it's going to be $24,000 a year. Who can afford that? $24,000 a year. So, what choice are they going to make?
I want to get to letters. We have a lot of them about this subject, so I'll get to as many as I possibly can. Bob says, for Dems to win the shutdown, they have to force Republicans to extend the Obamacare subsidies. For Republicans to win, they just have to do nothing. That sounds like the Republicans have the advantage. Then we go to JP. I and a number of my friends currently on Medicare plans have received notices that our supplemental plans are no longer offered. We have to scramble for new plans by the end of the year. I can't imagine how the Democrats are going to get the rap for that.
Absolutely true.
And then Ryan says, healthcare in this country is broken, a point that can be made and solutions argued about. Jeffries and Schumer badger at this point and hang their hat on it. It is frustrating. As a 30-something who's voted in every election since I was 18, I feel as though this is not the solution to turn out votes and win back control of either house. One expletive-laden quip or soundbite having one of these quote-unquote leaders calling the right for what they are, pillagers of the working man, would go so much further. Those crafting the Democratic message need to get their collective act together. Then we check in with Sophie. I hear journalists and folks in my community talking about possible paybacks when Democrats return to office. However, this presupposes that free and fair elections will take place. The normalization of National Guard troops in U.S. cities, the various redistricting campaigns, and the recent acquisition of Dominion voting systems by Liberty Vote, a company owned by Scott Leindiger, I believe that is it, a former GOP election official, led me to the conclusion that unless civil society, the courts, and Congress step in, we will not have free and fair elections for many years to come. Go to your happy place. If we agree that the ACA is not working, writes Devera, as planned, but we as a country do not want to disenfranchise millions of people, what has been proposed to replace it is more economically and efficiently? Question mark. Then we go to Vincent. In the 15 years since the passage of the Affordable Care Act, Republicans have tried and failed hundreds of times to repeal, both legislatively and in the courts. One of the major reasons why Obama invested so much political capital to get it passed in the first place is because his mother died from a serious illness and lack of health insurance. While I could care less about Schumer's political fortunes, I care a whole lot more about the 19 million Americans who will lose coverage or not be able to afford it if the subsidies go away, whatever it takes. Then we check in with Beth. Teresa's comment about Trump and everyone in the Stephen Miller orbit calling those who don't fall in line enemies is crucial to understanding the way the GOP is intentionally dividing us and setting the day-to-day tone. Rather than opponent or those who disagree with us, they employ outlandish hyperbole and use the words enemies, vermin, vile, hateful, despicable, the enemy within, and tell us that our hellhole cities are on fire. It is extremely important to pay attention to the climate they are trying to maintain and justify through their language. Barbara says Schumer and Democrats don't need health care as an issue for midterms, have stepped foot in a grocery store or paid an electric bill lately. I think there's a word missing there, but you get it. Then we go to Melanie. I just can't understand why Republican representatives think if they side with Trump, that they will get reelected. And Kevin writes to us and says, hey, panel, when President Trump wins the Nobel Peace Prize, do you think your heads will explode all at once or just one at a time? Maybe you'll just discredit the institution. Now, what did Obama win it for? Question mark. That from
I think it's
Kevin McCarthy. Yes, go ahead.
Interesting that the person who did win it, among other things, she did it for her work on free and fair elections, too. So I think that
in
was
Venezuela.
It.
In Venezuela.
Yeah, so I think free and fair elections, I think that was an interesting little note by the Nobel winners.
We have 1 minute. Anybody want to respond to any of those letters that I just read?
I very, very quickly, they say that, you know, Schumer's not breaking through. Well, he broke through to Marjorie Taylor Greene. I mean, she's the Republican who she was on again yesterday talking about the impact of these health care cuts and the even and it's affecting her own family.
And did she hit her head really hard or something? I mean, she is what a changed politician.
She got.
I shouldn't be mean because actually she's on side
her,
now.
Her
largely.
Sons. Her sons got their. Their notices of where what their premiums
oh,
are going to cost.
Goes, if you've heard
and
a
her
recent,
constituents.
If you've heard a recent interview with her, I mean, she must be afraid of her electorate, I presume. But what a transformation. She sounds like a reasonable politician. Now.
She's listening to her constituents. And I think other Republicans are going to start doing that. So if people need they want a better messengers, they can be messengers about what's the impact going to be on their health care coverage.
Oh, but by the way, to the point that was made about people worrying about their reelection, the problem is the way things are gerrymandered. Republicans worry about being primaried, right, which gets back to why we're in this position at the national level.
But at some point, the Republicans who quietly in the, you know, the cloakrooms are saying this is wrong, at some point they're going to hear from enough of their constituents like Marjorie Taylor Greene did, and they're going to switch on this. They're going to flip on this.
Well, she's really the. She could well be the poster child for, you know, restoring sanity. Let's see.
Peter writes to us and says, "I would like to see a bill by a Democrat that would eliminate health care for the Senate and House members. They make enough to buy their own." We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have many more items to discuss. We will go into a bonus round, a lightning round, I should say. We have a half hour. We'll go through as many topics as we can. In that period of time, we always welcome your letters, and today is no exclusion. By the way, great job on the letters.
Really good letters.
You've had it bottled up for a while. It's not very nice to let it go, isn't it? Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will continue after this from the BBC.
The exclusive kind. Is it too expensive? The world of your mind. But open the door.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. And as I said, we will try to get in as many topics as we can over this period of time. We have a half hour, and we will go through these issues that I have before me. We welcome your letters, as always, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We would be remiss not to talk about the Gaza ceasefire. Israeli ministers have approved the Gaza ceasefire, but tougher talks loom. The U.S. forces plan a civil military coordination center in Israel to provide humanitarian, logistical, and security assistance, according to an official, but will not deploy to Gaza. Israeli ministers late Thursday approved an initial ceasefire with Hamas in Gaza, a deal intended to bring 2 years of devastating war to an end. Mark Whitman.
Joe, there are two analogies that come to mind, and the letter writer that you read a letter from that referred to the Nobel Peace Prize talked about Trump's role in this. I'll put that aside for a second. To me, watching a peace plan in the Middle East is a lot like going to a SpaceX launch of one of their starships. That's the big one that keeps blowing up. It's brilliant when you see it get off the ground, and when you see it first start into the atmosphere, it's amazing that that can happen. It is so. The analogy here to the peace process is it is great that it seems like by sometime early or mid next week, the hostages will be freed and hostilities will largely cease in Gaza, and aid will start to come in. That's brilliant. But like the Starship launches, all other peace plans, right, have eventually blown up and disintegrated. It would be surprising if this isn't the case with this one at some point down the line, particularly given the sort of upside-down way in which Trump has done this, in which he says, well, let's take the initial steps and then we'll work out all the details at the end of it. And you could hear already either side, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu is signing on to a peace process that has a single state solution at the end of it. But he's told people back in Israel that he's opposed to a single state solution. And Hamas similarly has signed on to something that will disarm it and take it out of governance in Gaza. But they have continued to express their interest in being part of the ongoing governance of Gaza. So that's not to say, though, that this isn't brilliant. And it's also not to say that we shouldn't keep basically shooting for the stars, because like a single state solution and the eventual successful reinitiation of a U.S. space program, I think we all believe that at some point history will get mankind there. And there are necessarily a lot of failed attempts to get there. As to Trump's role in this, frankly, he's a lot like a safety on a tipped ball. I mean, those guys are incredibly in a football game. Those guys are incredibly talented. You don't get to the spot you're at unless you have a lot of political talent in Donald Trump's case. But get real. It takes a lot of circumstances to come together and a lot of luck for that ball and to fall in the hands of the safety and then for them to trundle into the end zone and have the winning touchdown. So the fact that he's helped get things off the ground, I think he's to be commended for. It probably does take somebody with his impetuous nature to start this off the way it has. Unfortunately, I doubt that impetuous nature will lead to the husbandry of this project that would be required to get it to success. But that's okay, because every time we do one of these launches, we're all better off for it, and eventually we'll find a solution. And we all hope that this one is it until we're proven wrong.
Judy.
Yeah, it's such a happy time, I think, for the people of Israel and the people of Gaza to have at least this shred of hope that the killing, this terribly bloody war, will come to an end. But I agree with Mark. You know, we've seen these things blow up many times, and the real work is going to come in the years ahead as the details of how this will be implemented, what will happen to Gaza going forward, what the role of Hamas will be, I think. And so Trump may deserve the Nobel Peace Prize if he sticks with this and makes sure all 21 or 20 elements of his peace plan actually come to fruition. And that's the hard part of this. I mean, this first step is important. I think he deserves all the credit in the world for it. But there's a lot more work to be done here.
I also agree that should the pieces fall into place, Trump may have well earned himself a Nobel Peace Prize. Certainly more than whatever Obama did when he got his, because no one knows why he got that, except he was really popular. And, you know, but that shouldn't be the motivation. I don't know that it is the motivation for all the people committed to making this work. Just really glad that it's in place, that it looks like it's going to roll out and hostages are going to be released next week. Already Israel is pulling back from some areas of Gaza, which is a good sign. It was clever to, leverage Netanyahu politically to make this happen. And it may be, I mean, there's all kinds of analyses as to why when part of it is certainly that Netanyahu reads the tea leaves, and he could see his support in the U.S., even in the Republicans, waning. And now is the time to broker whatever he can. And, you know, that's just part of it. It's just a lot of things have fallen into place and have been fortunately leading to this. And while I share the skepticism that just about everybody has about this, boy, you're really rooting for it to be a long-term tone down.
Teresa.
So, as I often say when we're talking about the Middle East, it's complicated. I don't really understand it in the way that I think my fellow panelists here do, and so I'll leave that expert analysis to them and others like Ambassador Fredhoff. I was thinking, I wish I could hear what he have to see. You know, yesterday I was thinking, I wish I could hear him or Malia Dumont, Jim Ketter, or others. But
although you're all good too.
No, I said my fellow. No, these guys. I said my fellow because they do talk about it in a way that I don't understand. I'm serious. There's three people here, and I really, it's very complicated. I don't really understand it, but I think these three do. And then other people, you know, like Fred and Malia and Jim. And I've never quite understood the politics and the dynamics of what goes on there. But it is welcome news. I listen very carefully to Secretary Rubio, who, by the way, looks exhausted, as well he might be, who keeps repeating over and over about how many more difficult steps there are to be worked out. And I think that is sort of ample warning. And we can hope it holds. We hope it's not one of those, you know, mission accomplished banner moments where it's good and then it's not. I do worry about, I applaud and just welcome relief the hostages coming out. I do worry about what happens to the people of Gaza who have survived. I hope that relief supplies are finally surged into the area, but in a safe way with the UN and those humanitarian organizations who know how to do this, as opposed to the groups that the Trump team had put in place who clearly did not. And we saw the awful, awful scenes of those desperate for food being shot, trying to get food. And there's been such utter devastation, not just for 2 years, but particularly in the last 2 or 3 months, just building after building being blown up. And so, you know, you worry about what's left there. Sort of as an aside, one of the things that I'm interested in is these media reports and the Trump people saying that what forced Trump to really finally pressure Netanyahu, because Trump did hold all the cards, of course. But when the Israelis fired on Qatar, and so it was not the wholesale destruction of Gaza. It was not bombing the hospitals where children and elders were. It was not bombing schools or blowing up building after building. It was the attack on Qatar that finally got him to pressure Netanyahu. And so I just find that, you know, just an interesting aspect of it that I think needs more attention. But for whatever it was, finally he used the pressure that the U.S. does have, because we fund the Israelis so much, to get him, Netanyahu, to draw a line and pull back. And hopefully this succeeds. We're interested to see what really happens next.
Can I talk about the Qatar thing just for a second? I mean, it's a little bit of inside baseball, but, and I don't have a calculator that proves this, but the assertion that the Qatar attack by Israel was the opening is baloney for public radio. There's another word for it. What the Trump administration should have done long ago.
But that's what his people are saying.
Yeah, they're wrong. Most of them know they're wrong. What they should have done long ago was call up Qatar and say, you got to throw the Palestinians out, the leadership out. Now, Trump wouldn't
Hamas
do...
Hamas or the Palestinians?
I'm sorry, thank you. Very specifically, the Hamas leadership out. Thank you. They should have thrown them out. Why? Because then they would have been free game for the Israeli special forces in Syria or wherever they ended up. And now that they are fearing for their personal well-being at that level of the organization, their incentive to do a deal has increased immeasurably. Why didn't Trump put political pressure directly on Qatar to stop trying to burnish themselves as the Switzerland of the Middle East? Could it have anything to do with any, say, gift that they gave the president a while ago? I don't know.
The airplane. No, that's exactly my point. It's the airplane. His business deals there.
Yeah, but my point is he would have called the Qataris to account earlier and should have earlier, but he didn't, and one wonders why. I mean, you can't – I have no calculator that proves any of this. But a lot of the – I just caution all the listeners, when you read – I don't care where you read it, New York Times, Washington Post, actually, particularly those two, about sort of the why and wherefores, 60-70% of that stuff in my mind gets encouraged by inside sources who have reasons to say, well, this is what happened and this is what did it. And I think I know you have to think very critically, because I doubt – that particular storyline of, oh, if Israel hadn't attacked Qatar, they could have. It's the fact that those Hamas leaders now fear for their personal safety. We could accomplish that long ago, much more simply than was done had the administration forced it. There are a couple of other lies that got exposed here, which was that the United States couldn't solve this. Every time Israel has stopped major offensives in the Middle East, or that I'm aware of, if not every, almost every, it's because America said enough, and this is no exception. One wonders if we couldn't have said enough sooner in this had we been more tactful. And even sort of some of the Jake Sullivan stuff about, oh, well, we're going to lay out a plan and have it all all the details, you know, in all the details locked in, and this is going to work. Jake Sullivan should have won the Nobel Peace Prize and every prize on the planet if that was ever going to work, because it was never going to work. You were always going to have to stumble through on the hope that the later stages would be solved on the go. And I think the Biden administration sort of failed to realize that, which is why this, some sense, fell into Trump's hands.
But not only did the Trump administration, you know, not say enough, there was a recent huge, you know, what was it, $6 billion new arms package that quietly they gave to Israel after, you know, clearly Netanyahu, they were using starvation as a tool of war, and after they just constant indiscriminate bombing, what do we have, 70,000 plus civilians dead? Yeah.
And why did 70,000 people have to die before this happened? That's the question people are going to, that haunts.
Right,
really.
Right.
Israel, if it wants to rejoin the sort of world of responsible nations, needs to hold itself to account to that to some reasonable degree on the other side of this.
But Trump never talked, well, I don't want to say never, I rarely heard him talk about the people, the innocent people of Gaza, in the way that he talks about in other wars, the innocent people.
Well, in fairness, he has rarely heard him talk about that. He has given it some attention. I mean, he talks about how awful it is and how devastating it is, and the pictures are terrible. I mean, he's very much affected by images on TV screens, and he did demonstrate that a couple of times.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up with our group, Judy Patrick, Mike Spain, Mark Whitman, Teresa Bourgeois. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. How did she know that? How did she see? Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Our final moments together with this group on this Friday edition of the Roundtable post fun drive. And again, we thank you so much for everything that you did to make us here today, to allow us to be here today. We weren't expecting it, and here we are, and we are more than a little excited to have a show, and we thank you very much for making that a reality. We have a few more things I'd like to discuss. One, a federal judge Thursday temporarily blocked federal agents with the Department of Homeland Security from using riot control weapons against journalists covering protests and immigration enforcement operations in the Chicago area. As federal agents have clashed with protesters in the Chicago area, and in recent weeks, journalists have been shot with tear gas and less lethal munitions, including pepper balls. Many of the incidents occurred outside an immigration and customs enforcement facility in Broadview, Illinois, a suburb west of Chicago. In her order, U.S. District Judge Sarah Ellis, an Obama appointee, prohibited DHS agents from dispersing, arresting, threatening to arrest, threatening, or using physical force against any person whom they know or reasonably should know is a journalist, unless there is specific probable cause to believe that person committed a crime. The 14-day order applies to all DHS agents, including those with ICE and U.S. Customs and Border Protection across northern Illinois. The lawsuit was filed on Monday by the Chicago Headline Club, a nonprofit that represents journalists. The complaint cited a number of incidents involving journalists, including a news editor for the weekly Chicago Reader being shot with a rubber bullet and tear gas. Four journalists with the website Block Club Chicago were hit with pepper balls or tear gassed while covering protests at the Broadview ICE facility. A Chicago affiliate of CBS said one of its TV reporters was driving when her vehicle was hit with a pepper ball, adding that the fumes entered the car and she felt as though her face were burning. The president of the News Guild said, "We are grateful for Judge Ellis issuing a temporary restraining order, making it clear that the government cannot use riot control weapons on journalists, media workers, peaceful protesters, and members of the clergy."
What a world, what a world, what a world. This is happening all over the country. Journalists trying to cover do their basic First Amendment a responsibility of covering the news are being attacked. I mean, in California, I think there were 120 incidents of journalists being attacked in this past summer alone. And it's not just ICE. It's not just sometimes it's local police. Down in New York City in the federal courthouse, we had one incident where a reporter was taken to the hospital after being pushed and shoved to the ground. Oftentimes, reporters will go to a supervising police officer when they're covering an event saying, hey, I'm here to cover, just so people know who you are. Sometimes they will wear a coat that says press, try to identify themselves so they don't get these kind of mistakes or outright attacks don't happen. What this does is make it so hard for a shrinking press pool to cover the news responsibly. And these are the kinds of protests that need to be covered. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that a student at Tufts got taken into custody for writing an editorial that was critical of the administration. This was for an immigration, questionable immigration status. But these kinds of suppression tactics are happening all over the country. And, you know, when there are certain websites, there's a Committee to Protect Journalists. There's a Press Freedom Tractor. These are both online websites. You can go and you can look. And the situation in the United States is getting as bad as it is in countries that we think of as repressive. I mean, journalists are being jailed for for expressing their opinion, for covering the news. I mean, we need to step up. Journalists aren't don't deserve greater protection than anybody else, but they're just trying to do their job, and the people who run the news organizations, we need to be there making this case. And you know, it's always been something of a problem. When I was an editor, I was sending a reporter into a volatile situation. Often I would send two, so at least you'd have a little bit of backup. But this continues to be a problem. It's not getting better. It's only getting worse.
Yeah, I'll just dovetail off that, Judy, that yes, journalists don't have there's no requirement that journalists get special treatment. They need to be treated just like everybody else. And threatening anybody who's peacefully protesting or present at one of these ICE facilities and threatening physical force against them or in any way, you know, attacking them with pepper balls and tear gas, et cetera, is wrong. And I think that needs to be established. The underlying problem here is, and in the other cases that you cited, it is becoming evident that not only are the journalists just standing there with the people being tear gassed, you know, and it was wrong for all of them to be tear gassed, they're being targeted. There's lots of anecdotal evidence that, oh, that guy's a reporter, let's rough him up, let's push that guy down. Like in the case in New York City, where I think the reporter was from Turkey. He was a foreign reporter. And they knocked him to the ground. He had to be taken to the hospital. And it does seem like there is an order, you know, rough up the journalists, push them back. And they're taking this opportunity at a time when, if you were ahead of a newsroom right now, you wouldn't have two reporters. You couldn't afford to send two reporters to a volatile situation because you only have a handful now. So it is taking advantage at a very vulnerable time for the news media.
All right. We are just about out of time. I want to thank all of you for being here, and I appreciate you coming in. This probably goes without saying, but we didn't know if we were going to have a show. We just put out an email yesterday and asked these four people to come in. They all said yes. So thank you so much for being on call. We really appreciate it. And again, it means so much to me to have you all here today. I hope you have a beautiful weekend. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. And again, thanks to our listeners for making the show possible and for helping out in the WAMC Fund Drive. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will have hour three of the roundtable, and we'll be back right after this short break.